For the first report, we switch you to London.
This is London at about 2 o'clock. Fred Bates speaking. 3 days after Mr. Churchill's statement in the House of Commons that Britain has been sending hundreds of fighter aircraft to the Soviet Union, the Air Ministry announced this morning that a wing of the Royal Air Force has arrived in Russia. This bare announcement gives no clue to the size of this British force which has gone to the Soviets. The number of squadrons in a wing varies with the types of planes composing it. It can be inferred that a wing is not less than 2 squadrons. Each squadron in the unit is, of course, sent complete with its own ground staff, technicians, and so forth. The Royal Air Force recently added a page to the history of air and sea warfare. A Hudson bomber captured a U-boat, as you know, and the entire crew at sea, holding them in a state of surrender for hours while awaiting relief. 2 of the plane's officers have just been decorated for this exploit. Squadron leader Thompson and flying officer Coleman, the pilot and navigator Baumeimer. The success of the operation was attributed largely to the teamwork of these 2 men. And here now is Squadron Leader Thompson, the pilot, to tell his remarkable story. Squadron Leader Thompson, please.
The Atlantic didn't look very interesting, inviting that morning when we left. The sea was rough and covered with angry white caps. Clouds were low and we kept running into patches of dirty weather. We flew a good many miles close to the sea. Nothing to look at but waves and clouds and rain. It was getting a bit monotonous. Suddenly there was a shout from my second pilot, "There's one in front of you." He pointed to the port bow, and there was a U-boat roughly 1,200 yards away, just starting to crash dive. They'd seen us too. The second pilot had a better view than I had, so I called out to him, "Let me know when it's time to attack, Jack." A few seconds later, my whole crew shouted, "Now." When I came round again in a tight turn, the sea was a foaming mass, and in the middle of it, the U-boat suddenly popped to the surface again. We dashed straight on her and opened up with all our guns. I had my front guns going. The wireless operator dropped to his tummy and wound down the belly gun in the floor of the aircraft, and the gunner in the turret was firing practically the whole time. We were using tracer ammunition, and the red streaks were flashing all around the conning tower and showering up the water all around the hull of the U-boat. To our surprise, just as we dived into attack, again, the conning tower hatch was flung open, and about a dozen men tumbled out and slid onto the deck. At first, we thought they were making for their guns, so we kept our own guns going hard.
Yeah.
The Germans were already out of the conning tower didn't like it a bit, and tried to scramble back again. Others were still trying to get out of the hatch, and they sort of met in the middle and had to argue it out.
Could you see them plainly?
Yes, we were close on top of them. They were wearing bright yellow life-saving jackets, rather like our Mae West.
That's what you call your life-saving jacket.
Yes, that's right. We attacked 4 times, and were just getting ready to dive the 5th time when they decided they'd had enough of it. They stuck a white rag out of the conning tower or something and waved it violently. We found out afterwards it was a shirt. We all stopped firing, but continued to circle them with all our guns trained. The Germans were determined to make us understand that they had surrendered. They had some sort of white board and were waving that too. We were still suspicious, so I dived right over the U-boat at about 50 feet and then flew alongside to see what it was all about. They followed us around with their white flag and we followed them round with our guns trained. The whole crew seemed to be in the conning tower, so tightly packed that they could hardly move. We were close enough to see their faces. And a glum-looking lot I've never seen in all my life.
I can understand that.
It was only then that we began to realize that we had really captured the submarine and that they really had surrendered.
When you realized that, how in the world did you expect to get her in?
Well, that was the snag. I even suggested jokingly to my second pilot that I should drop him by parachute as prize crew.
Yeah, how did he like that idea?
Oh, he didn't fancy it a bit. We were determined to get him ashore, if we could, submarine and all. So we sent off signals to our base asking for surface craft to be sent to pick them up. And soon we knew that several were on their way, steaming as hard as they could go. And other aircraft were being diverted to relieve us.
Now, what did you do all this time, in the meantime?
Well, all we had to do was to keep circling the U-boat with our guns trained to prevent the crew going below.
Mm-hmm.
We had to intimidate them and keep them in the conning tower.
Yeah.
We kept that up for 3.5 hours. It was a bit tiring. I didn't dare take my eyes off them for a single second. When we finished circling, I couldn't hardly turn my head at all. My neck was so stiff. The wireless operator had even a worse job, signaling furiously for 3.5 hours. At last, a relief aircraft turned up, the Coastal Command Catalina flying boat. We saw it coming and were scared that they were going to attack the U-boat. So we flew towards it, and signaling hard that it had surrendered, and we were trying to take her prisoner. I think the actual signal we flashed was, "Look after our sub. It is still the white flag."
You didn't want to lose that sub, did you?
The Catalina boys understood and began to circle her too. Then another Hudson came up and plenty more aircraft as later on in the day.
What about your own gas by this time?
Well, petrol was getting a bit short, so we had to turn for home. And that was the last we saw of our U-boat.
I bet you hated to leave her.
We did. Of course, the job wasn't anything like finished. We'd had the incredible luck to find the U-boat, but the Catalinas kept watch for hours, much longer than we did. Through gales and darkness, they stuck to the U-boat magnificently. And then the Navy came along, and they put up a grand show, too, taking the U-boat in tow and under most difficult conditions, and bringing her right into shore with all the crew prisoners. And we owe the Navy a personal word of thanks, too, for a very nice gesture they made.
What was it? Can you tell us?
Well, they came down to our station and handed over to the squadron a rather wonderful memento of the occasion, a memento of which we shall always be very proud, the U-boat's flag.
Thank you, Squadron Leader Thompson. And I guess you know how many people at sea and on land be happy to see the walls of your squadron's quarters covered with those flags. All the best to you.
Okay.
We return you now to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Thank you, Mr. Bates and Squadron Leader Thompson. That's the latest news from London. From the NBC newsroom in New York, this short bulletin before we take you to Berlin, Moscow. The latest Soviet communique says heavy fighting continued throughout the night in the entire front. That's the same wording the Russians have used for several days now. Now for the German side of the story, we switch you to the NBC staff member in Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is Alex Dreyer in Berlin. Germany's war in the East against the Soviet state entered its 13th week today with the Big Four, Moscow, Leningrad, Kiev, and Odessa, still in Russian hands. But the beginning of the 13th week apparently has not been able to alter the attention of the German press, which today again, as during the last several days, directs all of its wrath against the President of the United States. It seems that the German press does not like the president. The Diplomatische Politische Korrespondenz, semi-official Foreign Office publication, even came out with a new name for the president today. The publication calls him a mad imperialist. Virtually the entire front page of the Welkische Beobachter, official party news organ, is devoted to the president. However, the devotion is, of course, of a purely adverse nature. The newspaper bears the screaming headline, "The plutocratic mania for destruction knows no bounds." The headline refers to an article published in the New York Times, August 24th, written by Douglas Miller, former commercial attaché at the American Embassy here in Berlin. The Germans assert that the article, obviously inspired by the president, is nothing short of a four-point program aimed at the virtual enslavement of Germany. The Welkische Beobachter asserts that Miller is a close co-worker of the president, and adds, "The article is the blueprint of what Mr. Roosevelt would like to have Germany look like after the war." Again, news from the Eastern Front this morning is limited. There are reports of the Luftwaffe continuing its attacks against Soviet troops and lines of communication in the area between the Dnieper and Kiev, as well as north of the central part of the river. The German news agency, DNB, says the German bomber and Stuka formations effectively dispersed Soviet troop concentrations and tank units in daring low-level attacks. DNB says that bombs of all caliber were used in inflicting heavy losses upon fast-retreating Soviet columns. The Luftwaffe is also said to have bombed railway lines in the Soviet hinterland, causing communication jams at several vital points. Attacks against Soviet shipping on the Dnieper estuary are apparently still continuing. But there is nothing new as to what's really taking place around the cities of Leningrad, Kiev, and Odessa. The German High Command today, for example, referring to the Leningrad area, says that after strong German forces penetrated the defense belt around Leningrad, that the ring around the city is continually being drawn tighter, despite bitterest defense fire. In reference to the entire Soviet front, the High Command merely says that in the east, as a result of the favorable course of operations, new military successes will soon be achieved. And that's all the High Command has to say about the Eastern Front. Swinging to operations along the Western Front, the High Command says that west of the Faroe Islands, an enemy freighter yesterday was heavily damaged by a German bomber. The High Command also says that during the attack yesterday against an enemy convoy eastwards of Great Yarmouth, that a British destroyer was severely damaged. In North Africa, the Luftwaffe is credited with attacks on British anti-aircraft positions around Tobruk. The British, according to the High Command, did not fly into German territory either yesterday or last night. The last sentence of the High Command today is of interest in that it records the loss on the Eastern Front of the 4th German General, the commander-in-chief of an army group, Colonel General Ritter von Schobert. As a follow-up to the sharp statement directed against the President, which was read in Goebbels' propaganda ministry on Friday evening by the Foreign Office spokesman, Dr. Paul Schmidt, here's an interesting sidelight. Present at the conference was the likable and able Associated Press reporter, Ernst Fischer, who hails from Texas. I happened to be sitting next to Fischer and noted how careful he was in taking down notes. But it so happens that Fischer, in his story, referred to the 30-year-old Schmidt as youthful. Being called youthful does not seem to have aggravated the chubby little Foreign Office spokesman. But referring to Schmidt's youth in connection with the reading of a government commentary infuriated him. Fischer was publicly rebuked at yesterday's Foreign Office conference by Schmidt, who said that Fischer had indulged in journalistic gangsterism. Schmidt added he well realized he was not an old ass like some statesmen. Schmidt concluded his remarks that as far as he was concerned, the matter would be dropped, as there was nothing much more important, and things were more important at hand. Associated Press reporter Ernst Fischer was not present at the conference. The authorities here, well aware of the fact that as the nights get longer, the RAF will be making more visits, are again advising the population to be more careful during the air raids. A leaflet distributed all over Berlin today, for example, under the auspices of Berlin's police president, Count von Heldorf, bluntly states, the Berliner should not slacken his preparations for adequate air raid protection. The leaflet admonishes the Berliner to make sure that his air raid shelter is sufficiently equipped with anti-air raid equipment. He is told to be sure that his air raid cellar is stocked with a good supply of sand and water. The Berliner is also instructed to keep an emergency truck of clothing, just in case his home is hit. But when he goes into the cellar during a raid, should take at least his personal papers to prove identity and descent, his food and clothing cards, his insurance papers, savings books, and other important documents, as well as money and some underwear. The leaflet comforts him by saying that if his home is hit by a bomb, to report to the nearest government official, and in due time, his losses will be compensated for by the state. The leaflet ends its warning to the population with the statement, "Be calm. It's the will of the Führer that all who sustain damage during air raids will be properly taken care of. The men of the party, of the police, of the municipal administration, and of the anti-aircraft, anti-air raid society will perform the word of the Führer by deeds. Trust them, they will help you." This is Alex Dreyer in Berlin, now returning you to NBC in New York.
For the latest news at home and abroad, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company. Ladies and gentlemen, the worldwide Sunday evening news broadcast of NBC's Blue Network. In just a moment, we will bring you news from the restive Middle East, the tense Far East, and battling Europe. The men who will report to you are Americans, members of NBC's foreign staff, assigned to bring you first-hand reports of world-stirring events as they happen. For the first report tonight, we switch now to Ankara, Turkey.
Hello, NBC. This is Martin Nagranski calling from Ankara, Turkey. My report to you tonight is a tale of two cities, of Moscow and Berlin. My information comes from two trained and intelligent neutral observers, one from Moscow and one from Berlin, who arrived here during the past couple of days. The man from Moscow made the most striking observation. It was this, that Russia today is undergoing a non-violent, a peaceful revolution that will make the Soviet Union, if it emerges undefeated from this war, one of the most powerful and internally unified states of the world. The revolution is in most ways a revolution in thinking, and its main thought seems to center around the Soviet discovery at last that there is good as well as evil to be found in the Western world, that the influence of the Western democracies need not necessarily endanger or corrupt the heretofore hermetically sealed communist state. According to this observer, the Soviet awakening on this point could only have been brought about by the trial of blood through which Russia is now passing. Among the men in power in Russia, there is apparent now a lessening of suspicion of the Western world, and the growth of a mentality that may mean, when the war is ended, a lifting of the rigidly kept barriers by which the Soviet excluded Western thought and culture. Allied to this phase of the peaceful revolution is apparently a newfound mutual trust between those who govern and those who are governed in Russia. In the opinion of this observer, the Soviet rulers from Stalin down shared with the rest of the world, though naturally not to any comparable extent, the belief that if Russia were to become involved in a major war, there was danger of an internal breakup that might sweep away the foundations of the communist state. On the contrary, it appears now from the attitude among every section of the population in Moscow and from reports on civilian and military morale received from throughout the Soviet Union that the danger from outside has strengthened rather than weakened the ties between government and people. The most important result of this change is visible in the army, where the taboo has been lifted on criticism. And through the entire country, there seems to be enough feeling of internal strength that makes Russia a more formidable opponent with each passing day. For the Western world, according to this observer, these changes may make the Soviet Union, in one way, one of the most important factors to bring about the defeat of Germany. At the same time, however, a Russia that emerges victorious from this war, even though badly weakened as the Soviet Union undoubtedly will be, they will look around and decide it should have a share of the world's goods in proportion to its proved strength, and eventually, perhaps become the new Germany, with the present-day Germany's ideas of conquest, with which both Europe and Asia will have to reckon in the post-war years to come. From Berlin comes a different story. According to this observer, Germany is not going through any important change in mentality. It is ridiculous, in his opinion, for anyone to claim that Hitler has lost an iota of his popularity, or that the Nazi regime faces in any way a danger from within. Men, woman, and child among the Germans apparently realize that they must strive to the utmost to finish successfully what Hitler has begun. Behind this realization is the memory of the first bitter post-war years and the belief that if Germany loses this time, she will be struck down so that for generations she will not be able to be a great power again. The Germans have not yet felt the war deeply from the point of view of hardships and privations. The British bombing raids, except in a few industrial districts, have not caused much loss of life or dislocation of everyday habit. The food situation, due to the draining dry of the occupied countries, is not too bad on the whole. The one thing that is really making itself felt appears to be the terrifically heavy losses on the Russian front. The families of the men at the front, even though there are no public casualty lists, know of the heavy loss of life among their fathers and sons, and though these losses are accepted with resignation, they do not make for a happy population. There is no weakening of the war effort in Germany, but there is a dullness, a complete indifference as to passing victories and defeats, which is especially visible in Berlin. The determination to fight on to a victory in which they still believe still lives strongly in the German people, but there is this change. They realize fully today that the struggle will be bitter and victory a long way off.
Back in New York, from the far reaches of Turkey, we plan to switch around the world in the opposite direction, across the United States and across the broad waters of the Pacific, for news reports from the Far East.
Go ahead, Chongqing.
Hello, NBC. This is Mel Jacoby speaking from Chongqing. News in this capital today showed the Far East still waiting for conversations between the Japanese and American government to take definite shape. Despite the fact that there are indications Japan would temporarily withdraw from the Axis, the Soviet Union is apparently taking no chances. According to fairly reliable reports here in Chongqing, informed sources disclose that Russia was able to spare troops from the Western Front for the Far East. Daily troop trains of Soviet men and guns are reported going to the Far East, bolstering Siberian defenses and meeting the threat of a highly reinforced, mechanized Japanese army which has been rolling into Manchuria over the past 2 months. Japanese are reported to have protested in Moscow over Soviet reinforcements arriving in the Far East. Figures and details on the number of Soviet divisions arriving, however, were not yet available here. Attention in Chiang Kai-shek's capital here continues to be focused on Washington. Many Chinese now openly admit they fear that the United States will appease Japan, thereby weakening China's position. Although many government ministers managed to enjoy the first cool weather of fall away from the city, there was every indication that Chongqing was as jittery from the fear of an American-Japanese rapprochement as from a heavy bombing. Lam Parshall, one of the leading newspapers in Chongqing, editorialized that a Far Eastern Munich was brewing and repeated the belief expressed by the majority of Chinese people that any settlement between the United States and Japan now could be of a temporary nature only. Although there have been numerous press reports from Washington that America is trying to enforce a peaceful settlement of the Sino-Japanese undeclared war, there is no evidence here that Chinese leaders have been approached on the subject. Rumors to the effect that China and Japan are carrying on peace talks are denied in high circles here and branded as China Coast rumors only. Military reports from the China front this morning show more activity than in previous weeks. In central China, about 350 miles east of this capital, Japanese this week sent 40,000 troops on a foraging expedition on the south bank of the Yangtze River. Chinese trains have engaged the Japanese and inflicted 2,500 casualties. Meanwhile, Japanese have communicated their campaign has ended, and Chinese, on the other hand, claim the Japanese expeditionary force was unable to get any food as the rice crop had already been taken in. According to a report in the Communist paper published in Chongqing, Japanese have launched a major assault against the Chinese Communist famous 8th Foot Army in North China. The report states Japanese have 100,000 troops in the area and that they've used parachute troops against the communist guerrillas holding out in the mountainous country of North China. Fighting is reported still in progress. The Japanese Army Air Force has been reported particularly active this week all over North and Central China. I now return you to NBC.
And now for a report from the Netherlands East Indies, we take you to Batavia.
Hello, NBC. This is Sidney Albright. Time is 6:38 Monday morning. The Hollanders in the Netherlands East Indies have always admired the sentiment and idealism in the speeches of President Roosevelt. But as realists, and the Dutch are realists, the president's last declaration meant more than all the rest of his speeches put together. The effect is really sensational. The group here in favor of action instead of just words has now completely capitulated. The whole country appears to be solidly in back of President Roosevelt's policies. Most of the leading newspapers devoted entire front pages to the speech, with banner headlines and pictures of the president. The knowledge that the freedom of the seas will be maintained by the United States, regardless of the consequences, has struck a highly responsive chord in the Dutch, who are traditionally a seafaring nation. In an editorial entitled, "The Die is Cast," the Alabama Indisch Dagblad states that the speech of President Roosevelt is the last of a series of steps inexorably leading to war. The paper goes on to say, still the American people are not willing to engage the enemy with all the forces at their disposal. But for those who understand the character of this war, there can be no doubt that the steps which America has taken make it impossible to turn back. The fight has commenced, for the time being, over a restricted area. But soon the Americans will take their place in the ranks which are fighting the Germans and the Italians. A new and powerful ally has joined us. A America has come to realize that only an Allied victory offers the certainty of a safe future for the American people. America is not fighting for England, for the Netherlands, or any other country. She is fighting for herself, her own safety. Roosevelt made that clear enough in his speech. In conclusion, the article reads, "Finally, the elements in Japan that are still counting on the repugnance with which the Americans regard war will begin to see that there are things the American hates more than war, oppression and coercion. America is prepared to fight for her existence against any enemy who threatens it, irrespective of whether he lives in Berlin or in Tokyo." By now, this will have been appreciated in the Japanese capital. While sounding out government officials and prominent Dutch businessmen on their opinions of the president's speech, we were impressed by the unreserved respect and confidence in any future course of action decided upon by the United States. According to an official communique issued by the Navy Department, the 7,000-ton motor ship Kota Nopun, en route to the United States, is long overdue at point of destination. Based on information available, the vessel was most probably sunk by a German raider. The Kota Nopun was one of the finest cargo ships of the Dutch Merchant Marine. I now return you to NBC.
Next, we hear from the Philippines. Go ahead, Manila.
Hello, NBC. This is Bert Salen speaking from Manila. Although the situation here in the Far East is one of apparent calm and quiet, there seems to be considerable uncertainty as to where it will all lead. President Roosevelt's pronouncement of a shooting war to maintain the freedom of the seas, while it did not specifically mention Japan, certainly left no doubt in anyone's mind, least of all the Japanese, that they were included. No doubt, Japan was not specifically mentioned by the president simply because he wanted nothing to stand in the way of a possible settlement of the differences between the United States and Japan. While such a settlement is deemed of utmost importance and necessity by even the most rabid anti-Japanese elements, there has sprung up amongst those most vitally affected a feeling of uncertainty tinged with no little distrust. China, who feels she is most directly concerned with any plans for settling the Japanese incident, is reportedly lending an ear to certain negotiations for peace now being advanced by China's Benedict Arnold, Wang Qingwei, head of the puppet Nanking government. If we take for granted that these rumors are true, there can be only one reason for China lending herself to such a plan. It is because she feels that any readjustment between the United States and Japan can be made only at the sacrifice of her interests, and therefore she is entitled to try to make her own deal if a deal is to be made. A Chinese friend of mine, a rather high ex-official of the old Sun Yat-sen government, and whom I got to know quite well in Shanghai during the pre-war days, is now in Manila. I asked him last night what he considered would be a fair basis for a Sino-Japanese settlement. Speaking entirely as a private citizen, he said that the very least that China could be expected to accept was a complete withdrawal of Japanese troops and Japanese influence from South China, meaning, of course, Shanghai and Canton, together with the return of all occupied areas in China, with the exception of Manchukuo and Manchuria. The settlement of these last two named territories would be left up to a commission appointed for the purpose. Of course, there would have to be other considerations, such as cash reparations for damage done to Chinese property and for lives lost, possibly some trade concessions, and above all, a guarantee that all phases of the bargain would be faithfully kept. Well, if my Chinese friend is right, somebody has a real job to do. And the sooner they get to doing it, the sooner everyone here in the Philippines and the Far East will be able once again to plan for the future instead of living for today.